was thinking to myself, don't trip over that as you walk up there. And then I proceeded to do exactly that. Everybody, my name's Noah. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober since August 26, 1996. My home group is the Midtown Group in Bethesda, which they canceled tonight, I guess because of the snow. And I have a sponsor who I'm in pretty regular contact with. And I was thinking as we're coming down here about, especially the reading made me think of it also, that we hope these stories are not in bad taste and that they're a little self-revealing. And I thought in order to kick myself off that I probably need to be a little bit self-revealing and talk a little bit about some of my imperfections, just in case as I go on someone gets the impression that I got this thing licked and that I'm doing really, really good all the time, because that's not necessarily always the case. And so I was thinking about, you know, this past Friday, I got an email, and someone had not done. Am I not? Okay. I got an email, and someone had not done something that I thought they should do, and they did it not the way I thought they should do it. And so my first reaction was, because I already kind of don't really like this guy a whole lot, and I'm pretty sure that I'm smarter than him and better at him than what he did, because we have kind of the same job. So my first reaction was, I'm going to open up an email, and I'm going to send an email to some of my coworker friends and be like, can you believe what Brian did? Look at this dumb, but whatever, right? And so I started this email out, and I got maybe two or three lines into explaining why Brian was so dumb, and then decided, yeah, we're not going to send this. And so I deleted the email, and which I'm really glad that I did that. But my point being that my first reaction was that, you know, hey, I got an opportunity to look good and make someone else look bad because I think that I know better than he does. And, you know, so for those of you that have not been sober quite as long as me, there's some hope, something to look forward to. And, you know, but the fact of the matter is that throughout my sobriety, I have related far more to people's imperfections and the problems that they have and the areas that they struggle far more than, you know, folks where everything is doing fantastic and wonderful. And, you know, and as a matter of fact, you know, I've had the same sponsor. I've been sober about 18 and a half years. I've had the same sponsor for 17 of those years. I changed sponsors because my first one smoked crack, and that's not a good sponsor typically. or so I was told that one night. But the reason that I asked my sponsor to sponsor me is because and this was a year prior to me asking him, I was at like a Valentine's Day dance, and I was sober not quite 6 months, and so I had zero prospects, you know. And the Valentine's Day dance was terrible. It was a terrible thing to be at. And fortunately, my sponsor that day was also feeling a little bit uncomfortable, and he saw me standing in the corner by myself, wishing that I was anywhere else on the planet but there. And he came over and he chatted with me a little bit, and he told me that there was some other guy dancing with his girlfriend and that he was really jealous about that, and it made him angry. And this guy, you know, keep in mind, I had not quite 6 months. This guy had been sober for 8 years, which was forever. And I was quite certain that he really had it together. You know, he was probably showing up for work every day that he was supposed to be there. He probably paid most of his bills, which were things I was not capable of doing at the time. And, you know, so the fact that he had this, like, jealousy and it made him angry, for whatever reason, that stuck out to me, you know. And so a year later when I find out that my sponsor was smoking crack and this other guy was like, you need to get another sponsor right now, the first place that I went is I went to that guy. And a big piece of that was because I had that memory that that guy might be able to understand me because he had shared that little piece of imperfection, you know. And because other than that, I was terrified of him. When I walked away after asking him to sponsor me, I thought, what in the world have I just done? What a terrible idea. So, but, you know, 17 years later or so, it seems like things are going to be okay, and we'll stick with it. So let me get back to the general way, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And start off with my first drink. Well, a lot of people talk about how they were uncomfortable as kids and that sort of thing. And that was my experience to a certain extent. I remember when I was in the early teens, my dad was military, we were stationed in Australia, and I rode a tram to school. And it was cram-packed with kids. And there's one time I remember everybody would fight if a seat opened up. There was a huge fight for a seat. And I never got a seat. The one time that I got a seat was because somebody had stood up for an old lady, you know. And I pushed and shoved everybody out of the way and sat down. And here's this poor old lady getting ready to sit in the seat that I had just fought everybody for. And, you know, and I knew, what a jerk, you know. And so I got up and I got off the tram. It was not my stop. It was nowhere near my stop. I got up and got off the tram and walked the rest of the way home. So does that make me alcoholic? Not by any stretch of the imagination. What makes me alcoholic is that same feeling of wanting to run away, of wanting to, you know, hide, or wanting, the fact that alcohol makes that go away, that's one of the things that makes me alcoholic. And I discovered the fantastic world of alcohol when I was about 16. I was on an exchange program. I was in Germany for a month, and the first night that I was there, so we arrived at like 7 or 8 in the morning. I'm introduced to the family that I'm going to be living with. The dad happens to be the principal of the school that this is affiliated with. And they show me the town. There's these bike paths that you can walk from town back to the house. And we go out that night, and there's actually a big reception that they're throwing as part of another big party, but welcoming the American kids. And I lost my family because I discovered that I had a little bit of German, and I knew how to ask for another beer, please. And I was off to the races. And I remember walking to the bathroom that night and feeling like the sidewalk was on a 45-degree angle and thinking, this is why people drink. I totally get it. Now, if you ask me to describe what's this, I couldn't tell you. But I knew that this was amazing. It was awesome. I had a great time. I met the sheriff of the town. I fell over on some other VIP guy and, you know, got up with the band that was on the stage and was singing with the band, which was not my style at all. And I had a great time. And I was like, this is where it's at. So this is why people drink. Now I understand. And I lost my family. And it did not occur to me until I had been sober for many, many years that they may have been concerned about this 16-year-old American kid in a foreign country for the first time that they were responsible for and they couldn't find me. It did not even occur to me that that might be a problem. You know, and frankly, I didn't care. I was just having a good time. And I finally got back to the house that I was supposed to be living at, and they had locked the doors. So I went up on the fence and up on the roof and dropped down into the backyard and went in through a sliding glass door. And to me, this was just tons and tons of fun. This is going to be a great story. I can't wait to tell my friends when I get home about all this excitement. Again, zero concern for anybody, for the people that are actually responsible for me, you know. So that sort of thing went on like that. No concern for anybody else, just trying to have a good time. And frankly, not too many consequences. I had a lot of fun. I met a lot of girls when I was over there in Germany, and I had tons and tons of fun. We used to go out. There's a bridge, like a three-way bridge that meets over the street, and we would go out there. One guy played guitar, and we would sing the same like three bars of Bad to the Bone for hours and hours and hours. And one night there were a bunch of U.S. Army guys that were at this bar at a balcony down there, and you know I'm 16 years old. My dad was military, so I'm a huge fan of the military. And the fact that these, you know, 18, 19-year-old guys wanted us to come party with them was, again, like, you know, I've been drinking for 2 weeks, and I've already had some amazing, fantastic things happen, right? And so these guys want us to come party with them, and we're doing shooters and some little thing where we take the airplane bottle in our teeth and flip it up, and whoever has the lowest number on the bottom has to buy. And I didn't realize I was being had because they all knew which one was the lowest, and I always seemed to get it, ironically enough. But I didn't care because I was having a great time, and I felt like a big deal. What I didn't know and what I couldn't put into words at the time was that alcohol was doing something for me that I didn't realize it didn't do for other people. Like my brother, for example, he's not alcoholic. My wife's not alcoholic. They don't get whatever it is that I get from alcohol. I tried, when I got back back to the States and years later, I was living up in Pennsylvania. My brother lived in Northern Virginia with my parents, and I had dropped out of college because I don't need this stupid college degree. I've got partying, and I'm making like 25 grand a year. I'm rolling in dough. And You know, and at 19, that was relatively true, I suppose. But I kept trying to get my brother to come up and hang out with me because I was like, you are a nerd, and you need to understand what this can do for you, right? Because, you know, he played clarinet in the marching band, and I thought clarinet was kind of a girl's instrument. My dad played it. I played it. But for him, it was a girl's instrument, so he shouldn't do it. And I, you know, I kept trying to get him to come up and hang out with me because I wanted to introduce him to this amazing thing that I had discovered. And he was not interested. So, you know, I was 19, so that puts him at about 15. And he was very, very busy. He was extremely busy 15-year-old and couldn't ever quite make it up to come hang out with me. What I didn't know is that he was avoiding me like the plague. He saw exactly what I was doing to myself, to my family, to my friends, which I had no idea, but he saw what I was doing, and he wanted no part of it. Matter of fact, it was many years later that he and I had a long talk, and I had been sober for a little while, and he explained. He's like, you know, I still don't drink because I'm terrified that what happened to you could happen to me. And so that's impact that I didn't think I was having, right? Not that's negative impact that I didn't expect. And, you know, and so, but again, I was just trying to have a good time. And I was trying to introduce someone else that I cared about, well, that I thought I cared about, to this amazing thing. You know, the big book, I think, calls it the great panacea of all human ills. And I, again, could not have put those words to it. But when I finally looked up panacea and knew that it means like a great solution, or then I thought, yes, that's exactly right. Because it really was. It was my solution. And for me, you know, a lot of folks, I'm not like, alcohol was not really a problem specifically. I didn't think it was. You know, near the end of my drinking, I was, again, I didn't realize this was happening, but my world was getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. The people that were willing to hang out with me was getting smaller and smaller. Because I was not fun to hang out with for very long. Near the end, there was this guy named Matt, and Matt owned a pickup truck, and we both worked at a fire station, and then we also volunteered there when we weren't working. And so I lived there for a while, so I was there all the time. And Matt had a pickup truck in the back of the firehouse, and we would go back there, and he had a cooler full of beer. And we weren't going anywhere. We were just going to sit in the pickup truck in the back and drink, because that's social and normal, right? And he opened up like 6 or 8 cans of beer and put them on the dashboard. And I asked him why he did that. He's like, well, it gets all the fizz out so you can drink them faster. I was like, that is brilliant. That is so smart. Matt's the coolest guy I know. And so I started doing the same thing because then you can drink them faster. And I didn't drink beer much because I did get all burpy and full and I couldn't drink it very fast. You know, I loved the mixed drinks because, you know, I loved the Long Island iced tea because there was no tea in there. And a rum and coke was good because your first drink, I had a system, which I made this system at 16. The first one is a little bit of rum and a lot of coke because it doesn't taste so good. And then as you go into 2, 3, and 4, you get more and more rum till you can just do rum, glasses of rum. And I was like, I should teach this to someone. I should write a book. This is brilliant stuff. But like I said, I didn't realize what was happening. I was just having fun, trying to have a good time, and I was hurting people left and right. I was kicking, you know, people didn't want to hang out with me. People didn't want to spend time with me. And if you had said, hey, has this ever affected your job? I said, no, I show up for work all the time. Whenever I'm supposed to, I show up. So I worked on an ambulance at the time, and I would work 2 24-hour shifts a week, 24 on, 48 off. And I had to be at work at 8 o'clock in the morning. And the first thing you do is you go through your gear checks. You check the ambulance. You check all the bags, all the backboards, make sure you got enough of everything that you may need. And then there's some office work that needs to get done until 4 o'clock, and then it's kind of your free time. Well, for me, I had the flu a lot, and so I would get to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I might help you check the oil, but then I'm laying down because I'm not feeling good. Because the night before, I was out till like 4 in the morning, and I figure, you know, hey, 2 hours of sleep, I'm sober, good to go. So I have no idea how many times I drove the ambulance, still messed up from the night before. And that never crossed my mind until, again, I'd been sober many, many years. And it never, you know, who knows who I had opportunities to help that I didn't or couldn't or didn't pay attention to because of that. I really have no idea. But that was the kind of damage that I was doing. It didn't look like damage to me, but I was hurting folks. There were people who didn't want to hang out with me. Nobody wanted to spend time with me. So I eventually got to this point where I was very alone, and this girl that I was dating, who I met while dating another woman, I met this girl, and she was dating somebody else, but we figured that's cool, no big deal. So I moved in with her, and yeah, like she showed up at my 21st birthday party because she was friends with someone else. And then I moved in with her like 3 or 4 days later because, you know, it was true love. And so it was maybe 6 months later or so. I don't remember exactly what happened, but I was pretty upset. And she wanted me out of her house for some reason, which I didn't, because I was home. She got home from doing something else. And I was home asleep, and she started beating me on the back with her cordless phone. And I sat up and I said, if you hit me with that again, and I used some other words, and before I could finish my sentence, she clocked me across the side of my face with her cordless phone. Well, so I did what any, you know, self-respecting, you know, military-raised man would do, which is not true at all. I punched her in the mouth and I knocked her out. So then she called a couple of her friends and said, Noah just hit me, and then hung up the phone. So I don't know what you would do in that situation. What I should have done is I should have left. But I was like, all right, so there's two dudes coming over. Let's see what happens. And so one guy came over, and they started yelling and screaming at me because she's, you know, bleeding down there. And so these two guys proceed to beat the snot out of me because I was cocky, and I told one guy, I was like, if you're going to get in my face, you better step up and take a swing, or you better go home. Well, he felt confident enough with his brother there, who was a lot bigger than me, that he was okay with that. And so I got my butt whooped. And that was not my first butt whooping. It was not my last. But it was by far the most memorable to me, personally. And, you know, so my parents lived down in Northern Virginia, so I went down to Virginia, and everything was fine. I had to go to the hospital, which is the hospital that I took people to in the ambulance all the time, so I knew all the doctors, administrators, and everything. So it was kind of embarrassing. I wasn't too proud of it. Couldn't go back to the fire station with a bloodied face and whatnot. So especially after these guys worked me over, I was in bad shape. And so I went home. And then 2 weeks later, I talked to my girlfriend, and we decided that she had a drinking problem. And she was going to quit. And I was like, well, that's really good of you. Let's do it again. So and because I'm such a really good boyfriend, I quit drinking too because I'm very thoughtful and loving and caring, you know, because I punched her in the mouth. And so I quit drinking with her, you know, for her. And that lasted about 3 weeks until one night she kind of went out with the girls to go do something and I went out with the guys and I thought, well, I mean, quit drinking is relative, right? Like, I quit drinking with her. Right? So I'm just going to have a beer. So that night ended up with me trying to hunt her down and find out who I thought she might be with and slashing tires of cars of people I didn't know because I thought she might be with them in a hotel somewhere. Which, you know, again, that's manly. That's what my dad taught. That's how my dad raised me. And which, again, that being facetious, that's not true at all. And so one of the things I didn't realize was happening, right, is I have these terrible reactions, and I behave very poorly, and I behave in a way that I know I was not raised. I have zero excuse to act that way. You know, my parents are still married. My dad retired from the Navy after 27 years. My mom was a real estate agent. She was a secretary, and my brother was grown. He grew up in the same house, drinking the same water, you know, having the same upbringing, going to the same schools. And he's fantastic. He's married. He's got 3 kids. He's got his name on a whole bunch of, I can't think of what it's called. He's got a bunch of inventions for his company that his names are on. So he's the only like non-director person that they gave stock options to keep him around. Like, he's doing fine. And he does not need to go to meetings and to tell people about his imperfections and to tell people about what alcohol does for him or to him. He's fine. He's different from me somehow. And I forgot where I was going with that. It was very important. Anyhow. So, we'll get to Sherry's favorite story, which is me getting sober. And what happened was, this girl, the same girl that I had been dating forever, or not forever, for nine months or so, was forever at the time, the one who, you know, I had punched her in the mouth and whatnot. So we had another big blow-up, and I had broken up. We had broken up, and I moved out in the middle of the night while she was at work because, you know, that's what manly men do. They run in the middle of the night. And so I had an apartment down the road, and she called me about 2 or 3 weeks after that. And when she called me, she was telling me about this new guy that she was with, right? And I thought that was kind of rude, and I was a little sensitive. Now, keep in mind, I had cheated on every girl I had ever dated my entire life, because there's not enough of anything for me. If I get attention from you, or you think that I'm good or smart or whatever, there's somebody else in the room that disagrees with you, and that person bothers me. And so the fact that I had behaved this way all my life, and now she was doing this to me, so I thought, actually, I don't have any actual evidence of this. This is just the evidence that was in my head. I thought, I'm going to kill that bitch. Now, a few years or so before this, I had taken an arson investigation class, because I was a firefighter and worked as an EMT. And they talked about this one thing. They said it's very, very difficult to prove that it's arson, and it's even more difficult to prove who did it. And I don't know why, but I thought, I'm going to write that down. That's interesting information. And I kept that in my head. I don't know if any of you thought that was interesting information that you might need in the future, but I did at the time. And so I knew that she was out. I had stolen a key to her apartment because who knows when you might need that, right? Or actually not even to her apartment. That's even worse. I lied. She was living in a trailer at the end of a street of like regular homes that her dad bought her when she got pregnant with not my kid. And so I decided I am going to go rig her trailer to blow up when she gets home, and I'm going to kill her because you can't treat me this way. Now, again, I come back to this was not the way that I was raised. And so I did that. I eventually got arrested for that, and we'll get to more of that story later. But I literally tried to blow up her trailer. And again, I know somewhere inside that this is not how I'm raised. This is not right. This is not what I'm supposed to be doing. And I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what it was, but I knew something was wrong. Now, the beautiful part is, I couldn't put two and two together. I knew that when I drank, I didn't worry about that stuff. I could not have told you I'm going to drink so that I don't worry about it. I just know that when I drank, I didn't worry about it. That kind of stuff didn't stress me out. And I didn't really, hey, I am who I am. If you don't like me, so what? So I get arrested, and I go call my parents. My mom thinks that I'm joking with her when I call her and tell her what's going on. She thinks I'm kidding. And finally, I'm like, Mom, I'm not kidding. I actually got arrested, and, I might need some help. So I, did, again, the manly thing. I moved home and wound up going to court. My lawyer said that the best he's going to do for me is 2 to 5 years. And I remember at that time thinking to myself, what does one wear when they go to jail? Like, what am I, like, obviously I'm going to get a jumpsuit or something when I get there. But what do I wear from here to there? Because I don't want to, like, make anybody angry, because I know, like, I want you to think I'm a tough guy, but I know that I'm not. And so I don't want to get my butt whooped when I get there, and I don't want to look pretty either, you know. So I'm thinking, like, I don't know what to wear, what to do. But it was that moment, Sorry. That moment was the first time that I remember consciously being afraid. Because normally fear turned immediately into anger and rage. But that's the first time I consciously remember being afraid. So I went back home. My lawyer, who said 2 to 5 years is the best we can do, which sounded like a really, really long time. And he said, maybe you should see an anger management counselor. And I threw crap off his desk. I'm like, I'm not angry, you know, because I wasn't. I'm fine. I just, you know. And, you know, the funny thing is, a lot of the little troubles that I got into, the fights, the, you know, kicking the dog type stuff, when I had that stuff going on, it wasn't because I was toasted. It's because I wasn't. You know, when I was toasted, we're good, man. We're cool. And that girl, when we were both drinking, we were having sex. We were having fun. There was, like, drinking is clearly not a problem here. Now, I didn't note that maybe not drinking might have been a problem. I didn't note that. I knew something was wrong. And I thought maybe I needed medicine of some form, or maybe I need a psychiatrist, or maybe I need something. Because clearly whatever's happening is not right. So I go to this anger management counselor after like one session with me, and then she takes my parents in another room to talk with them. She said, have you ever thought about going to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I was like, no. Like I had seen, I don't know where I got these ideas from, right? But I pictured a bunch of old guys, trench coats, right? A single, you know, one light swinging back and forth in the dark. And I'm 22 years old. And I'm all alone, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm in the prime of my life. And I'm thinking, that sounds like a terrible plan. And she said, well, it would look good for court and you may not have to go to jail for as long. Boom, birth of willingness. So my parents, I did not know this until I had been sober for a handful of years. My parents had been going to Al-Anon because they knew what was wrong. I didn't. So they had ready. They had a big book. They had a where and when. They had all kinds of stuff ready. And I thought, wow, that was fast. So I go flipping through the where and when looking for a meeting because I'm living with my parents again at this time. And for those of you that are unaware, when you live with your parents, they get to tell you what to do no matter how old you are. At least that's the way it was in my house. And I told my mom I was going to go to a meeting. And she said, well, what meeting are you going to go to? And I thought, well, now we're getting really specific, you know. So I have to go. I find a meeting that sounds good. And I found a young person's meeting. And to give you an idea of kind of where I was mentally. So I had just been arrested for 2 felonies and 2 misdemeanors for trying to kill my girlfriend, trying to blow up her trailer. I just got fired from I was a police dispatcher. That was my full-time job. I just got fired from that job. I've moved back home with my parents. You know, so life is looking up. You know, they talk about scorecards read zero. I was zeros across the board. But when I saw a young person's meeting, I thought, oh, I wonder if there's going to be girls there. because apparently I thought I had tons to offer. And I told my mom that I was going to go to this meeting, and so the Tuesday night comes up, and she says, hey, it's, you know, getting to be whatever time, don't you think you should be going to that meeting? And I had forgotten about it, and I freaked out on her, because you're not going to tell me what to do. Now, again, she's paying my bills, she's paying for my attorney, she's feeding me, she's housing me, she's clothing me, but you can't tell me what to do, I'm old enough, you know. So we had a big fight, and so it took another week. And so that Tuesday night came up again. It was that same young person's meeting. This time it was my idea, so I'm good to go. I'm going to go check it out. So I go to this meeting. I pull up to the church, and I pulled up, you know, to the wrong side of the parking lot where there was nobody parked. And I look in this window in the basement because I knew the meeting had to be in the basement because that's where they were in the movies. And I see all these, like, musical instruments lined up. And then I go around the front, and that's where there's, like, 40 people that are somewhere between, like, you know, 15 and 30, and they're all standing outside, they're smoking, they're laughing, they're giggling, and I thought, this must be the band, you know, the church band, or some high school band that practices here or something, so I need to get through this crowd without making eye contact with anybody or without engaging anybody in conversation, figure out where this meeting is, and get this thing done, so that I can tell my lawyer that I went so I don't have to go to jail as long. So I plow through this crowd, and I go wandering around the church looking for this meeting, and I walk into a room that's got like six or seven really old ladies. And I'm not going to pull numbers out because that's just rude. But I was 22, and I could tell they were really, really old. And they were sitting around this table, and I thought, oh, we found it. This is what my life is going to be. Me and this these six old ladies for the rest of my life. Woohoo! So I walk in, and they said, can we help you? And I said, AA? And they're like, no, that's on the third floor. I made a sigh of relief, man. I was so pleased that that was not it. So I go upstairs. By this time, I'm late to the meeting because I only gave myself like a minute and a half before the meeting, you know, to get there. So I go upstairs. I walk in. And when I walk in that room, it's all of the nerds that I saw standing around outside. And it looked like a Gap commercial, you know. And I instantly judged everybody, right, because there were khakis and plaids and, you know, sweaters. And I was like, oh, God. You know, because I was living in South Central Pennsylvania. I was a volunteer firefighter. I was working as a police dispatcher. I was a true badass redneck, right? Which is not true. I just played one because that's who I was hanging out with. So that's what I acted like. So I certainly didn't want to have anything to do with all of these, you know, clearly college nerds, you know. And so I sat down in the only open chair, and they started asking for people that were new. And there happened to be a very attractive girl sitting next to me, and she elbowed me. And at the time, I thought, how does she know I'm new? Now I know exactly how she knew I was new, because I stood out like a sore thumb, and everybody that goes to that meeting pretty much knows everybody else. And so she knew that I did not belong there, or had not been there before. And so I stuck my hand up and introduced myself as, you know, I don't remember what it was. I may have even said I was alcoholic because other people did, and I did not want to draw attention to myself. But I'm not sure about that. So after the meeting, this girl, she's like, hey, do you have a big book? And I said, you mean a Bible? She said, no, one of these. And she handed it to me. And I was like, man, this chick wants me. Because I'm so out, you know, like I said, I had so much to offer. And so she introduced me to her boyfriend, who took me to introduced me to all the guys that were at the meeting. And something happened. These guys were interested in spending time with me. They were like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? You know, hey, we're having, there are people coming over to my house tonight for some pizza. Why don't you come over and have a slice of pizza and watch this movie with us? And nobody had invited me anywhere for quite some time at this point. So I went. And before I made a commitment to go to the meeting the next night, I found that girl. And I was like, hey, where are you going tomorrow night? And she was going to the same meeting. So I was like, all right, I'll be there. Because, like I said, I was a big deal. So there was definitely attraction and not promotion that got me to go to a second meeting. You know, and honestly, and I make a joke about that, but the fact of the matter is that I don't know what it is going to be attractive, right? I don't know if there is some girl that may go to a meeting because I happen to wear a tie tonight. I have no idea. My job is to, when I'm here, my job is to do the best that I can, not to be like, not like I have to go to the gym so I can be attractive for somebody, but my job is to be on my absolute best behavior and to share my experience with other folks and to share a little bit about what's wrong with me so that someone else might be able to relate to that. And because that's what these folks did, right? During that meeting, I remember thinking to myself, because remember, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And during that meeting, I had this thought that maybe this is what's wrong with me. And we were reading the second step out of the big book, and there was a line in there that said, do I now believe or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? Now, I was very anti-God and anti-religion, and because, you know, religion is for stupid people, for, you know, people, like, it was invented in whatever year to control the masses. I'm not going to be controlled like that, so all y'all that believe in that stuff, you're dumb. That was my attitude at the time. And so when they talked about God, I was like, oh, man, all this God. And they talked about, actually, you know, the reading is all about a higher power, a power greater than yourself. And I'm like, I'm smart. I know you're talking about God. You can't fool me, people. But when, for whatever reason, when they read that line, that jumped out at me. Do I now believe, or more even willing to believe? And for whatever reason, I thought, I suppose I could be willing to believe. And I had the thought of, maybe this is what's wrong with me. Because people talked about their alcoholism. They talked about what it was that made them different from their fellows. They talked about things like being in a room full of people and feeling all alone. Now, again, I could not have put all those words together into a sentence, but when that guy said that, I knew exactly what he was talking about. There's a few other things that they talked about that I can't think of off the top of my head that were very specific that night. But I had that thought that maybe this alcoholism thing, maybe this is what's wrong with me. Because I related, because people were talking about alcoholism. And one guy talked about, that day he had run from the cops, but it turned out the cops weren't following him. They were following somebody else, you know. But he took off and ran from the cops anyway. And I was like, I understand that all too well. And so these guys, they gathered me up, and I went to this guy's house for pizza that night, and I got home, and I got home at like 11:30 or midnight or something like that, and I woke my parents up, which they appreciated immensely, because I wasn't doing anything, but they had to go to work. And so I woke them up, and I told them about this amazing experience that I had had, and they couldn't have cared less, because they were not thinking that something might change in me, right? And plus I had all kinds of other great solutions prior to that. So they were not as excited as I was. But I had made plans to go pick up this guy, Drew. Drew lived at the house where I went that first night. And I made plans to pick up Drew. Now, what I didn't know is Drew had a brand new Acura. And he told me that he needed a ride to the meeting, which I thought, I was like, this is a big, like, I have a car. It was in rough shape, but I got a car, and I'm going to pick Drew up. And if I don't, Drew's going to die, right? That was kind of the attitude that I had with it. But what happened was, so I picked Drew up, and Drew lived at that house, and one of the other guys that lived at that house was a guy named Lynn. And Lynn was the guy that would become my first sponsor. But I would pick Drew up. Sometimes Lynn would ride with us. I'd go over to their house for dinner, and I hung out with those guys all the time. And what happened was I would tell Drew little bits and pieces about things I had done, you know, some of my attitudes, some of the things that I thought. And he would tell some stories about himself. I'm sure I don't remember ever listening to them, but I'm sure that he must have talked about himself from time to time. And one time I said the kind of the secret bad word, which was, sometimes I think I'm just a nice guy that drank too much. And Drew was like, all right, so you got this, you tried to blow up your girlfriend's trailer, you've had physical altercations with your mother, you've been beat up, you tried to pull a bartender over the bar and then got your butt whooped another time. That was because he cut me off and I hadn't even finished the neck off my beer, but he thought that I was too drunk and that I had to leave. And I was very upset because all I had is the neck of a beer. So I grabbed him by the shirt and started to pull him over the bar, and I did not get him very far. So Drew went through this. Those bouncers are fast, man. So Drew went through this litany of things, like he had actually been listening to what I was saying. And he told my story to me in 3 or 4 minutes, and he's like, so, you're a nice guy that just drank a little too much. And for whatever reason, I kind of believed him that maybe there was something else. Now, the other thing that was going on at this time is I was accidentally getting involved in service. Because Drew had service positions. He had things that he had to do, so he had to show up early. He had to stay late. And I kind of felt a little silly if I was just going to stand over there, so I would help Drew out from time to time. And so I had Drew's service also. And I had to pick Drew up because he was going to die if I didn't get him to the meeting. And what happened was I got some of my own service positions without Drew. I got this guy as a sponsor because he kept nagging me whether or not I had a sponsor. And I thought clearly he must get like bonus points or something, so I might as well let him get off my back. And yes, you can sponsor me if you want to. And which that was kind of how I treated it for a while, is if you want to, you can sponsor me, but that's not exactly how it really works. But I started showing up. I started doing Alcoholics Anonymous by accident. And my sponsor was really, really smart. He backed me sideways into doing the steps. He wasn't like, all right, Thursday, we're going to go through the first step. And then we're going to do your fourth step. And then we're going to, he just got me in sideways. Like, I called him one time and I told him about all these people that were really pissing me off. And he's like, really? You should make a list of all those people. I said, that's a good idea. So I started making a list. And he's like, and so I go through this list, and then he's like, how's your list come along? I said, man, it's long. There's a lot of jerks that I know. And he's like, did you put next to them like what they did that made you so mad? And I was like, that's a good idea too. You know? Now, the sad thing is, I don't know how many four-step meetings I had been at and heard people talking about those things, but I did not make the connection until one night I was at a four-step meeting and I realized, I was like, I'm doing my four-step. I have been tricked. So I promptly stopped because then I recognized what was next and I was terrified of that concept. And I had a really good friend, a guy named Brendan. And Brendan called me one night and he's like, hey man, I really, really need your help. And, you know, who am I to deny someone help, right? He said, but I have to do some homework. Why don't you work on your fourth step and I'll call you back in a few minutes to get the help that I need. So I was like, all right, well, you know, while I'm up, I might as well. So I finished my fourth step in about an hour. So it took me like 3 months and an hour to do. And Brendan called me back and he's like, how's it coming, man? I was like, well, I think I'm done actually. And he's like, cool. I said, what do you need help with? He's like, I got it. I've been had again. But I made a plan with my sponsor, because the other thing that was happening at this time is the other guys that he sponsored, they were doing their fourth step. They were getting service positions. They were getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were calling their sponsor and telling on themselves. I would call Brendan and tell on myself. And then when we were all hanging out at dinner, Brendan would say, hey, Lynn, did Noah tell you about whatever it was that day that I had told Brendan? Because I wanted to tell my sponsor, but I was going to tell him in private and quiet, you know, because not everybody needs to hear this stuff. Because, you know, I was being a jerk at work or whatever it was. But it was very private to me. So I did my fourth step, did my fifth step, and in that time frame, I started helping other people too. And I didn't know exactly that that's what I was doing. But I, you know, my sponsor's like, that guy looks uncomfortable. Why don't you go say hi? And I was like, well, what do I say after hi? He's like, he'll figure it out, you know. And so I did a lot of that. And so what happened was, we finally get to I'm about 6 months sober, and now court's coming up. Now, I've had a couple of people from AA. My court was in Pennsylvania. I got sober in Northern Virginia. And a couple of people would come up to meet my lawyer with me or come up to do various things with me up there. And I had to go up for court, and there was a guy that came up with me for court. And he had been in jail. And so he was telling me about how bad jail is. And I'm expecting to be in jail like that night. And, you know, some weird things happened. And I won't go into the details of the weird things, but I will go into a little bit of detail because part of it's important. About 6 weeks or so before I decided I was going to kill my girlfriend, I had enlisted in the Marine Corps. So I'm 22, decided that obviously I'm not a man. I know that for a fact. I think a lot of other people are starting to figure this out. The Marine Corps will make me a man. And I called my grandfather, who was a Marine, like a real Marine in Guadalcanal, that sort of thing, and he said I was stupid. And then he's like, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. And I was like, no, I'm tough. It'll be good. He's like, no. So I got arrested before I went to boot camp, but my recruiter went to bat for me. So that it turned out that I didn't have to go to jail. I had a really short probation. In all honesty, no big deal at all. But now came time, because the part of it was I had to, you have some certain period of time before you go to boot camp. From the time you sign the papers till you go to boot camp, there's some number of days that limit. And so all my probation was done the day before that I had to ship out for boot camp. And that was the way it was designed. Because it turned out the judge, guess where he got his law degree? Through the Marine Corps. So a lot of little things kind of came together to help me out. And so it comes time. Now I have a job. I'm working for my mom's company as a secretary at the front desk, which was terrible because obviously I know I'm way too smart for this kind of a job. But my sponsor kept telling me, why don't you get a better job? And I was like, well, I don't have any experience. I don't have college. I mean, I can't. He's like, so this is about the best job that you can get. I was like, yeah. He's like, all right, so this job is not beneath you. You're a little bit beneath this job, which is true. So but now comes time I got to make a decision. I'm about 6 months sober, maybe actually probably closer to 9 months by this time. And I got to make a decision. Am I going to go be a Marine and do what I said I was going to do? Or am I going to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and do this thing? Now, it's possible I could have gone to boot camp and stayed sober. That's possible. I don't know. Because the choice that I made was that I was going to stay here and I was going to do this thing. And I'll tell you what, that weighed on me very, very heavily for many, many years. You know, like I said, my dad was military, my grandfather was military, both of them had fought in wars, and I knew as a kid that someday I was going to join the military, and I was going to do the same thing, but it never happened, never did it, and I felt terrible that I had done that, and the longer that I stayed sober, I got kind of involved, not in politics exactly, but I got to following the news and following politics and that sort of thing. And I just remember thinking about, you know, all these guys that are out there doing this thing. And this, again, this may mean nothing to you, but this was very important to me. All these guys that are out there overseas doing this thing, putting their lives on the line, being in danger, getting hurt, getting killed. And I signed up to do that kind of stuff. And here I am getting fat and happy. And, you know, and for me, that just didn't sit right. But I didn't know what by that time I'm like 30, I'm married. You know, I told my wife, I was like, honey, they're looking for helicopter pilots in the Army. I'm going to sign up for the Army Reserves. And she's like, no, first of all, you're not. And she had a bunch of other reasons, but the reasons weren't all that important. It was, no, you're not. Because she had married a software developer that sat in a cubicle in Reston, right? That's what she married. She didn't marry a helicopter pilot, because what I didn't realize was you sign up for that, the next day you're gone for about 18 months or so. And there was a reason why they needed helicopter pilots. And so she was not cool with that. And I told my sponsor how incredibly selfish my wife was, that she wouldn't let me go do this. And he had some other suggestions for me. But what happened was I had been following my sponsor's direction as much as possible. And years and years and years before this had started this very strange series of circumstances and these jobs that I got with different people, and I didn't know where I was going to wind up and I didn't know what I was going to do. But I got just weird things kept lining up. And eventually I wind up in this place where I am, you know, working with the Department of Defense. I'm doing, tactical targeting stuff. I'm helping to protect and defend the guys that are over there doing that stuff, right? Now, again, that may mean absolutely nothing to you guys. But to me, it's, and I kind of hate the word miracle, but it's the word that I just popped into my head. Whenever someone says, oh, it's a miracle, I think, you're an idiot. But it really is, because that whole circle has closed, you know, because I'm able to do something that I thought was very, very important to me. I'm able to help folks that I thought that I was leaving, that I had just left in the dust to go do my own thing. And not because of that specifically, but because of the steps, because of being sponsored, because of showing up, because of doing the things that I'm asked to do here, I get to live a pretty comfortable life. You know, and I'm a big believer that for me, it's important for me to have a comfortable life, because it's when I'm uncomfortable that alcohol starts looking really good. You know, and when I'm not in regular contact with my sponsor, or when I'm behaving poorly at work on a regular basis, and I'm not paying attention to myself, and I'm not looking at what I'm doing, somehow, and I don't know how it works exactly, somehow all of these people that I know in my home group or the meetings that I go to regularly, all of a sudden there's not a soul to talk to. All of a sudden I walk into a room full of people that I know, that I care about, and that I know care about me, and I feel all alone. And it's at times like that that I know what makes that feeling go away. I know what makes that discomfort go away. And it makes it go away fast, too. The side effects kind of suck, but it makes it go away fast. The good news for me is that Alcoholics Anonymous does the exact same thing. It makes that feeling go away when I'm in the middle of it, when I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Like I said, when I'm calling my sponsor, when I'm reaching my hand out to someone else that looks uncomfortable. And when I'm trying to share my experience and to share the little things about me that are imperfect with somebody else. When I'm doing those things on a regular basis, oh, and also the other thing, is I'm helping make meetings happen. You know, whatever it is that I got to do to help this, to help a meeting, the meetings that I go to on a regular basis, whatever I got to do to make those things happen, I get a great reward, which is I get to feel comfortable. I get to feel like those places are home. And that's one of the reasons why a home group is so important. You know, I was thinking about this morning, I was thinking about coming here. And a lot of people, when they start a talk, they say, oh, I'm honored to be here, honored to be asked. And for a really, really long time, I thought, well, that's just kind of what people say. You know, but coming up here today, I really feel that. And one of the biggest reasons is that I know Billy really cares about this group. And he really cares about what's going on. And he cares about the message that comes here. And so the fact that he called me and asked me to share a message with you guys is a big deal. And so I am truly honored to be here. And thank you very much for asking me. And with that, I'll sit down. Thank you very much.